I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hi, this is Billie Jean King.
This is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carrillo.
This is Pam Shriver.
This is Yannick Noah, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
So, folks, there are 2 days remaining of the Australian Open, and we now know our final lineups, because along with the women's singles final tomorrow night of Ash Barty against Danielle Collins, we also now have a men's singles final to look forward to of Rafael Nadal against Daniil Medvedev, a repeat of the 2019 US Open final that I think it's fair to say we all quite enjoyed. Today's two semi-finals weren't quite the thrillers and epics that David Law promised you yesterday, but they were good. They were good, David. I don't think you're going to be asked for refunds, but there might be the odd grumble here and there.
I thought Berrettini would make more of a fight of the first match early on. I didn't expect him to come up against a Nadal quite like that. And I didn't expect Berrettini to just look so ordinary for the first two sets. So I expected a five-setter there. And I was surprised that Tsitsipas faded the way he did. But actually, I also think that Medvedev forced him to fade because he was absolutely incredible at the end. But they were two really good semifinals that I enjoyed immensely. And they do set up the most wonderful prospects for a final, because I do have very happy memories of that 2019 US Open final. I remember you and I after that having what's that thing, the honey juice, while we recorded.
Grey Goose honey juice.
Oh, I mean, that's a memory I'm looking forward to getting back to if we go there again. But, that was an incredibly draining but exhilarating final. And I have really, the only downer of that particular podcast was that Matt wasn't with us, but I do remember it very fondly. So if we get anything like that on Sunday, I think we're in for a treat. And I think that is definitely possible.
Yeah, and look, we will talk about that final and everything that is on the line, because we are aware that there's quite a lot on the line in that final. We know that there's a big old men's Grand Slam race going on, and we love to talk about that. Everyone in tennis loves to talk about that. But let's deal with the semi-finals from today first. Let's start with Nadal's victory over Matteo Berrettini, 6-3, 6-2, 3-6, 6-3. I mean, the first words I've written in here in the agenda are Nadal is incredible. I'm going to struggle for words, I think, a little bit for Nadal's achievement this fortnight, and for most of this semi-final. Look, he did fade physically, and that is going to be a feature, I think, of how we all preview the final. I think that's a worry. His foot pain grows as a match goes on. That seems to be pretty evident. But the tennis he played for two sets was utterly sublime. It was just heyday Rafael Nadal tennis. And full disclosure, this is not a prediction that I need to offer after the fact, but when it was decided that match was to be played under the roof, and there was no choice in that department, because today has been a day of weather, folks. I got sort of detained. Oh, we shouldn't use that word. This Australian Open.
I ended up in sort of lockdown.
Can't really use that word these days either. I ended up a hostage to this storm that came into Melbourne today, and I couldn't leave the house. It was that serious. The trams are all haywire. I couldn't get an Uber. I tried to get some food delivered and it kept on getting cancelled because the roads weren't safe. When I finally managed to get out to get into the tennis midway through the second semi-final, it felt like escape from Alcatraz. It really did. It was a really epic moment. But anyway, I watched the first semi-final with the storm swirling around me, getting increasingly worried about the materials that our Airbnb is built from, because it really sounded like we were about to spring a leak any minute. But yeah, the roof was closed at the start of the match, and it seemed likely all along that it would remain closed. And I feared for Rafael Nadal when I heard that, quite frankly, Matt.
Yeah, I wasn't sure what to make of it, just because... Yes, Nadal said himself, I'm more of an outdoors guy, didn't he, in his interview with Jim Courier afterwards. And generally, he has preferred playing outdoors. I think he's only ever won one indoor hardcourt title in his career. That was all the way back in Madrid 2005, I believe. But then again, I think it was good for Nadal that it wasn't hot. And that feels like a weird thing to say, because traditionally Nadal has enjoyed the heat, but we saw how much he faded physically due to the heat against Shapovalov. He actually did say in the Spanish portion of that press conference after the Shapovalov match that it was heat stroke that he was experiencing. And so I felt like it was perhaps a benefit for him that he didn't have to contend with that, at least today. And then when the match started, I obviously had David's words ringing in my ear. I was expecting a classic. I'd been sold a classic, an epic.
Oh, Matt's asking for a refund. Of all the people, David, it's Matt that's asking for a refund.
I was feeling like a bit of a fraud, I have to say, at 6-3, 6-2.
Well, I was with you, David. I thought that Berrettini would trouble Nadal sort of no end from the start, and actually... what those first two sets revealed was that it was just way more of a matchup problem for him than I had realised. I mean, obviously, we spoke about the backhand being such a weakness and such an area for Nadal to target, but it was pretty alarming for Berrettini how much of a weakness it was, how easily Nadal was finding that backhand, and just the pattern of the match was just all in Nadal's favour through those opening stages.
I felt really sorry, actually, for Matteo Berrettini, because it was like he'd been stripped naked out there. Imagine sort of the one thing that your one weakness being prodded at, by a bully. It's like when your sibling knows exactly the thing that you're most embarrassed about, and that's the thing that they make fun of you for,
Yes.
Must have felt like that for Matteo Berrettini, because everyone knows he knows, and he knows that everybody else knows that the backhand is a massive relative weakness as much as it's improved. And, Nadal, he is the master at exposing a weakness. He's extraordinary at it, and he was exposed out there for two sets.
Yeah, and it reminded me of the conversations we've had about Berrettini in the past, and buried a little bit, actually, because we've known he's got this weakness, but he has managed to sort of overcome it and do really well in slams recently, obviously Wimbledon final last year being the highlight. But we have said before that the big four really have sort of brought in an era where you can't have a weakness. Songa's backhand was always a bit of a weakness. Burdick's movement, Ferrer's lack of a weapon. There was a reason why these guys didn't break through in the biggest matches against them. And Berrettini sort of fits into that mold. He's got strengths, but he has a weakness. And I thought we did see, Nadal just exposed it today. Mm. And also Nadal, his own tennis was unbelievable in those first couple of sets. The the way he was hitting his forehand. I thought his backhand as well. It was almost like, you know, it was a bit of a troll because he was hitting his backhand so well to sort of set up points and just use it to get his forehand into play. It was vintage Nadal for the first couple of sets.
He wasn't adhering to Carrillo's first law today, was he, Matteo Berrettini?
None of the laws.
No, the laws are hold your serve, hide your weakness and have a weapon. Now, on a good day, obviously, he can do all three of those. You know, we've got plenty of evidence now of Matteo Berrettini, but for two sets, didn't do any of those. And he fronted up to that impress, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. I asked him about those first two sets because he said he expected more of himself. And I said, so, you know, what were you expecting? And he just said, my attitude was bad. I was in the wrong mood, was the phrase he used to describe those two sets. He didn't say it was flat. He just said, my approach was wrong, really. And I thought that was a pretty honest assessment. He's also got the problem that one of his ways of hiding the weakness is to use the slice. But that's an absolute no-no against Nadal because slices fit right into Nadal's topspin forehand. And that's just what I mean about it being even more of a matchup problem.
Yeah, if Nadal hitting to your backhand is, you know, being made fun of by your sibling, then giving him the slice is, you know, like a wedgie.
I've noticed that Nadal's footwork is like the Roadrunner cartoon when anybody hits a slice to him. He sort of spots it immediately that the guy's opened the face of the racket. Oh, he's hitting a slice. Right. I don't care where this is going. I am not hitting it back with a backhand. He can hit it right onto my backhand side. I'm going to get over there and hit a forehand winner. That's the end of it. He takes it almost as a personal insult if somebody dares to hit a slice to him, and he's just going to make them pay. And that's what he did, I think, right at the start of the match. And then that amps up the premium on Berrettini striking through his own backhand. And actually, as he got into the match in that third set, he started to just decide, I've just got to hit the thing. I've got to go for it because it's the only way possible. And occasionally he nailed a few. You know, it's not like a shot he can't hit. He just can't hit it with any reliability. But there was, I mean, I think you make quite an important point. I think it's so easy to focus on the game plan of Nadal was perfection, and he is brilliant at identifying a weakness and going for it. But I think that slightly does down his own performance to focus too much on that. He didn't just play his normal self today, which is always very good, pretty much. Today was exceptional. Today he would have beaten pretty much anybody, I think, for those first two sets. That was just dominant tennis, and he was just a better player than the guy.
It was, for two sets, it absolutely was everything you've just described, but he did fade, didn't he? Mm. He did fade. It was his will and animalistic competitive instincts that got him over the line, I think, in that fourth set. I think a lot of us were anticipating a fifth, maybe. David, you sent us a text saying, Berrettini's eyes are wide here. He sees opportunity. He sees a man on the ropes. And my goodness me, the credit to Nadal for breaking the Berrettini serve and getting across the line. But how big an issue is that physical fade that we've seen in Nadal for a couple of matches now?
It's an issue for sure. He's actually lost the third set in half of his matches here because he lost it to Khachanov, he lost it to Shapovalov, and he lost it again to Berrettini today. Definitely an issue. And it does seem like sort of fade is the best description. It's not like he can't play, but he really has to manage his energy levels, I think. And there was this period in the match where Berrettini won 23 points in a row on his serve from the sort of middle of the third set to when Nadal actually ended up breaking him decisively in the fourth set. And I think part of the reason was because once he wasn't winning the first couple of points in the service game, he was sort of checking out of those games.
He was economising, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was conserving. There wasn't any need to get into those games. It was most important to protect his own serve at that stage. And I was watching the match in the stadium with Simon Briggs, and don't want to throw Simon under the bus here, but I'm going to. He thought Berrettini would win the match in the fourth set when there was such a physical difference between them. And I just said, yeah, Berrettini definitely has the physical edge, but I still back Nadal mentally. You know, I still back him to maybe finally get into a service game and pounce. And he sort of knows when to push Nadal. And in the end, I do think that is what happened. I thought Berrettini, when he lost his serve, it was actually his forehand which let him down. You know, all the talk about the backhand, it was the forehand that made the errors. And that combined with Nadal's will and his sense of the moment, you know, it was just all too much for him.
He's peerless in that regard, in terms of will and sense of the moment, I think. Let's talk about his reaction after winning. There was disbelief, there was pure joy, and then there was this real Andy Murray-like outpouring of emotion, you know, extremely Andy Murray-like, actually. Really gave me chills and sent me back to Andy Murray, Washington 2019, it would have been, wouldn't it? And Matt spoke to him about it in press. He was asked a lot about it in press and was extremely open about it. And it sounds like those tears came from an extremely similar place to Andy Murray's in Washington in 2019, Matt.
Yeah, it was a question from Ben Rothenberg, actually, about the tears at the end. You know, he said, what was going through your mind then? And he said, well, conversations I've had with my team, with my family in the last few months about retirement, you know, about the possibility of not being able to come back from this injury. And yeah, it is... I don't want to say a miracle, because it's, you know, it's a lot of hard work. He sort of stressed that as well. He said, I've worked really hard to get back here. But his career was on a knife edge over the last few months. He really did not know whether he was going to be able to play again, certainly at the level that he's displaying this week. And yeah, it just caught up with him. It just, you know, obviously we're going to talk a lot about 21, and that is actually the thing that Nadal plays down the most, the sort of significance of 21. And I genuinely do believe him when he says that. What is most important for Nadal is he's back, he's competing. And he used this phrase on Eurosport, I think it was, David, to Mats Wilander, saying that he feels alive again. And that's what I asked him about. And he said, yeah, I feel alive because I can play tennis again. My tennis career has got life. And I didn't know that it would have. And that, for Nadal, is the most important thing about this tournament and what he's doing here.
I think he's keen to be open about this element of it, because I don't think he feels that we quite understand and believe him or appreciate how close he was to genuinely having to not play tennis anymore. I don't think he... And we can't know, can we? Because we weren't there. And what he was saying is those people that knew my diary every day, that kept the same diary as me, i.e. my team, those that were in my environment all the time, they know how desperate it was, is what he's saying. And we don't. All we see is him coming out and making mincemeat out of Matteo Berrettini for two sets, and that takes some doing, because he's a good player and he's more than 10 years his junior, and he's a strapping bloke, you know. And here's Nadal, mid-30s, somehow managed to get himself back out there and be competitive, and actually not only competitive but reach the final. And I think Nadal's mind, it kind of is a miracle. He can't quite believe that this has happened, given how close he was to not playing at all. And my mind also goes back to the conversations he and Federer had a few years ago, when they talked about their time at the Rafael Nadal Academy, I think, when the, you know, one of them was on crutches and the other one couldn't play either, and suddenly they were both back in the final, you know. And I just don't think we do appreciate exactly what it is like to try to go through that level of rehab and go to the depths of despair, almost, of thinking it's over, and trying to face up to that, and then suddenly finding out that you've got another chance. I mean, Roger Federer must be there right now. You know, just imagine if Roger Federer manages to make some sort of comeback next year. I can't see it, but I mean, I don't think we're probably in that far a different situation with what Nadal has just experienced.
So on Sunday, we will have Rafael Nadal going for Grand Slam number 21, which of course would pull him away from Novak Djokovic and Roger Federer. They're all on 20 at the moment. Federer had his go at getting to 21 at Wimbledon in 2019, of course losing the final from match point up to Novak Djokovic. Oh, Djokovic had his bite at the cherry in the US Open final last year, lost out in three sets to Daniil Medvedev, and now Nadal gets his chance. It is so perfect. Matt did a smile about this today that up until now has only been reserved for when the free ice cream comes around in the media room.
I love the Grand Slam race.
I thought you were going to say, I love the free ice cream in the media room.
Well, that goes without saying.
Yeah.
It's the brand is Connoisseur, honestly. He's like, oh, Connoisseur one.
And he is one.
His eyes light up. Anyway.
But look, I mean, honestly, there has been, I think, some people in tennis, you know, perhaps even us on occasion, you know, where we've felt a little bit of big three fatigue, perhaps, and we've been, you know, we've been waiting for it. But, you know, it has been my tennis watching life, the Grand Slam race, and I am so invested in finding out how it finishes. And it keeps changing course and changing direction. And, you know, obviously this tournament was set on a very different path with everything that happened with Novak Djokovic and set the Grand Slam race on a different path. But I didn't expect Nadal to potentially capitalize on that here, because as everything David's just outlined of just how unlikely it is that he's even playing this event. And I do believe Nadal when he says his future happiness does not depend on breaking this record. I really do think that is genuine, and he has this perspective on it. And yet at the same time, when you watch him play, he is so ravenous and so hungry, and being able to separate those two things I find astonishing. And it's such an incredible mindset, and it might in the end be his greatest sort of power. It might be the thing which sort of gets him to 21 first rather than the others. I'm all in on the Grand Slam race, and I'm excited that it's in play again on Sunday.
I've been working on an analogy which is not quite there yet, and I fear I'm not going to get the help I need here because, David, you're too old and Matt, you're too young. But anyway, I'll throw it out there and see if you can work with this, David. Work on an analogy where Federer and Djokovic are Oasis and Blur, and, you know, it was all about the battle between them.
Hang on, isn't this the 90s?
As
this
to who would be
David's
the greatest.
I mean, spot.
I am a bit offended. Let's just get that in there right now. That was right in my university years, and I know more about Blur and Oasis than you do, is my guess. But carry
all right,
on.
Well, bear with me then. Well, I just assumed if it's right in my sweet spot, then you're a bit older than me. Anyway,
you were 11.
Stop digging.
But there we are.
Federer and Djokovic were Oasis and Blur. Mm-hmm. And everyone assumed that one of those two would go down as, you know, the great, and then Nadal is pulp, who have just low key because of their longevity, low key just quietly gone about becoming the ultimate. And Andy Murray might be like the Verve or something. I'm getting the impression, David, that you're not familiar enough with pulp's material.
I know exactly
from the
who pulp is. I'm very
no, but
much
I mean,
questioning
more
whether pulp.
Material.
Yeah, I am questioning that one as whether they're pulp, any better. But better than Oasis, don't think so.
Well, there we go. Unqualified to comment. So do let us know what you think of my completely unfinessed theory.
Well, I mean, the thing about Nadal is, it's tough to see him as the third one, right? Because he was right there alongside Federer, really, at the start. You know,
so were Pulp, though, Matt.
But what I find interesting is Nadal was on Federer's case really early in Federer's career. I think people can forget that. And now he's on Djokovic's case. So this idea of sort of longevity is true for Nadal, isn't it? You know, he's had the most injuries, but he's still going, still doing it. It is incredible.
Mm. Okay, is anyone still talking to me? Shall I attempt to proceed with this podcast?
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Tennis Podcast listeners. David here. Now, you might know that I love a bit of cooking, and I think I'm quite good at it. But if I'm honest, even I get fed up trying to work out what to do every night. That's where Home Chef comes in. Being able to put together a delicious meal without the long prep and the cook times, well, that's pretty cool. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. They have over 30 options a week and serve a variety of dietary needs, so you don't have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, but it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. Now, for a limited time, Home Chef is offering Tennis Podcast listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life and, of course, free shipping on your very first box. Go to homechef.com/tennis. That's homechef.com/tennis for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard it right.
Daniil Medvedev will also be going for actually what I think is low-key, quite a significant record himself on Sunday. No man has ever won the next slam after winning their first. In fact, only one man has ever even reached the final after winning their first Grand Slam, and that was Andy Murray. Obviously, Daniil Medvedev has already matched that and can go one better. Women have done it, of course. Multiple women have done it. Most recently, Naomi Osaka's done it. But no man has ever done that.
In the Open era.
In the Open era.
Yeah, that's a really big deal. Yeah, that feels big to me, I have to say, especially because when I think of people like Pete Sampras, when he won his first one, he was 19, and it took him a good 2.5 years to win his next one. He's kind of struggled with that weight on his shoulders, and I think a lot of these players, when they break through and win one early on, of course, Medvedev isn't that young. He is in the peak of his career, I think, right now. He's perfectly attuned, but it's a really big achievement, and we're going on to talk about the match he's played and the Nadal match, but just strikes me how much he's loving being part of this big three situation in terms of his role as disruptor and determining potentially which way it ends up going.
Yeah, and I think that's a really interesting aspect of this because, as you said, he is that much younger. He referenced that, you know, when he was a child, he would hit against the wall and pretend that the wall was Federer or Nadal, and now he's influencing the race right when it's at its sort of peak. And I think he is enjoying that. He said straight up, didn't he? I'm going to enjoy the chance to deny someone else history, just as he did to Djokovic at the US Open. He's going to try and do it to Nadal as well. It suits his personality. It suits his sort of villain role in men's tennis, really.
It enables him to say everything with a smirk, which is really how he wants to be saying things. We'll come on to his post-match press conference, trust me. But first, let's talk about the match. He beats Tsitsipas 7-6, 4-6, 6-4, 6-1, obviously, to make his second straight Australian Open final. It was until the final set, which was unexpectedly one-sided, even to Medvedev, he said in the press conference afterwards, he was very surprised at how easily he was able to win that fourth set. But until then, It was an extremely high-level match from both players. Tsitsipas, I thought, mostly played really well. And yet, he didn't come that close tonight. There were moments where it felt close, but I think overall, stepping away, big picture, I don't think he actually did get that close tonight. Medvedev had a gear that Tsitsipas didn't have. Tsitsipas made no inroads whatsoever on the Medvedev serve. And okay, Tsitsipas served well tonight, and Medvedev wasn't making great inroads on his serve either. It was quite a serve-dominated night. But the numbers for Tsitsipas on Medvedev's serve are terrible. Now, there is also discrepancy in these numbers, which makes tennis look pretty terrible, because it is so tennis that two different, completely legit sources for these statistics say completely different things about these statistics. But one source says that Tsitsipas won a total of 18 points on the Medvedev serve tonight out of 100. And another source says that he only won 14 out of 100. And just for context, last year in the straight sets defeat of Tsitsipas by Medvedev, and bearing in mind after the match today, Tsitsipas said, look, I played way better tonight than I did last year when I was, you know, really out of gas after the Nadal match. And I'd agree with that. He did overall play better. He did a lot better last year on the Medvedev serve. He won 21 out of 82 points. Now, it's still not great, but it's better. So actually, in the really key area, which I think is the return, he just wasn't getting anywhere tonight, Tsitsipas. And that's a problem, I think.
Yeah. It is, I think, especially in this day and age, you know, return is so important. The best players in the world over the last few years have been the best returners, and it is an area of weakness for Tsitsipas. And yeah, Medvedev, I felt like Medvedev was the author of that match. He was the one controlling it. You know, when he needed to in that first set tie break, he was 4-1 down. But he raised his game. He found the shots when he needed to. He pocketed that first set, which was so important. Similarly, we'll come on, of course, I can't believe it's taken so long, we'll come on to aggro, outburst, drama, all of that. But Medvedev sort of self-destructed a bit at the end of the second set, start of the third set. He was, you know, the architect of his own downfall in a way in those moments. And then he helped himself again by raising his level, not letting that outburst properly make him sort of tailspin out of control. And then in the fourth set, he ran away with it. He had the physical edge, and by that point, he just had Tsitsipas right where he wanted him. So I felt like the same as you, Catherine. Yes, Tsitsipas played better tonight. Yes, he got a set. Yes, there were moments when it was close, but I felt like Medvedev had levels he could go to that Tsitsipas didn't. And largely that's because of the surface. You know, I think put this on a clay court, it's a different story. But hard court at the moment, Medvedev has definitely got Tsitsipas's number.
Yes, let's talk about the aggro, shall we? Let's just get straight to the heart of the matter, because end of the second set, things are extremely close. Well, the two opening sets were extremely close. Tsitsipas was 4-1 up in the opening set. Tiebreak, Medvedev then surged back, hit a couple of just absolutely stunning and improbable shots. One forehand passing shot that he squeezed into a space which you didn't know existed before he hit it. And I think another trademark backhand drill down the line. Both of them just amazing. But so end of the second set, Medvedev gets broken. He loses the set. He's unhappy. And as he's walking back to the chair, he does a gesture which he explained in press afterwards as just sort of flapping his arms around to the crowd. He wasn't happy with, you know, the crowd calling out between second and first serves. It was an extremely pro-Tsitsipas crowd tonight. So he said he was just generally, you know, flailing his arms about. And the umpire, Jaume Campistol, gave him a visual obscenity warning for that, which is a new one on me, I think.
Well, I've seen that one a couple of times. So I'm thinking back to the finger that Medvedev put to the side of his face during the US Open.
Did he get a visual I don't think he got a visual obscenity for that, though.
I think he probably did post-match.
I've seen visual obscenities, David. Trust me. I just don't think I've seen them given.
Jimmy Connors used to get them all the time as well, back in the day.
See, this is why I thought you'd be too old to know about Blur and Oasis. Anyway, I take it all back. Why have I brought it up again? So he gets the visual obscenity warning, and then he sits down at the chair and he channels some frustration towards the umpire. And it's mostly quite fun and pantomimey. It's over the line, I think, because it's so personally directed towards the umpire. That's always what makes me a bit uncomfortable. And he's specifically saying, why aren't you giving Tsitsipas a warning for coaching when his dad's talking all the time? And he's saying, look at me.
Yeah, and he said, why are you so bad in a Grand Slam semi-final?
The personal nature of it towards the umpire was not, it was not our ideal form of aggro. But there was a highly amusing moment where he goes off court to change his kit and he again says, you know, you need to be looking at Tsitsipas's dad and giving him a warning. And if you don't do that, you're a little cat or a small cat, was it?
Small cat.
Small cat. And there was a lot of rewinding the footage. Obviously, we couldn't do that because we were in the stadium, but we were relying on David and various other people on Twitter to clarify that he really did, in fact, say small cat. Mm. And obviously, on reflection, it is now clear that he was very cannily saying small cat in order not to get an audible obscenity warning for what he maybe possibly might have meant, David.
Yeah, and possibly as well verbal abuse, which is probably a more serious code violation because, you know, he was calling the umpire directly a name, basically, which is, it's not on really. I mean, that was funny. I did find that funny when he was shouting at the umpire. I had my kids in the room and they just sort of stopped what they were doing. You know, they're kind of half watched sometimes playing with games and all the rest of it. And then suddenly they stopped and you could see they were quite scared. They were quite scared of him. They were quite rattled by how angry he looked. But I mean, he was red in the face. He had lost it a bit there, had Medvedev. He was shouting at the top of his voice. Okay, the umpire had got his back to him. And that was almost part of the problem because he felt he wasn't listening to him. And he was just saying, listen to me, answer the question. You know, and he was getting more and more irate. And I did think we're right on the edge here. Not, I do think this is pushing over the line, but we're right on the edge of this going getting really out of hand and me almost turning it off, you know, because I don't, there's certain things I don't really want them to have to see. It's quite interesting. I mean, there are a couple of things. One is I actually thought in the first three sets, I think the higher notes of the match came overall from Tsitsipas. I think to me, it was like watching Roger Federer against Novak Djokovic. It felt like one of their matches where there's this guy who's trying to create and then there's this guy who's just who's basically snuffing out all of that creation and blunting it. And one of the best matches I've seen Tsitsipas play for three sets against Medvedev, probably the best overall. And he was coming up with answers. He was taking it to him. But what that rant did was helped Medvedev get his frustration out of his system and reset. Because when he came out again, he was calm. And he was getting the chances in that third set. He was staying with him. Okay, it took him a while to break. And then in the fourth set, he was incredible. I thought Medvedev's form in that fourth set was like Nadal in the first two sets tonight. And I actually think that that's the biggest thing for the final. I think Nadal's got to win it quickly. I don't see him doing to Medvedev what he did in 2019, put it that way.
No, same. Just on the aggro, he apologized to the umpire at at the handshake, which obviously isn't a handshake in COVID times. He was seen saying, I'm sorry, I'm really sorry, and then he doubled down on that in press afterwards. He was asked whether he ever regrets. I think it was Ben Rothenberg again that asked him whether you regret these outbursts you have in the heat of the moment. He said, all the time. I always regret them. And he said he regretted that one tonight. You know, he said he'd to battle all of that. But yeah, it's, I think, you know, he understands it, and he's not sort of saying it's never going to happen again. He's not making those kind of promises.
John McEnroe used to be like that, didn't he, Catherine? I mean, we got to know him on the Champions Tour, and the difference was he wouldn't apologise a lot of the time, but he wouldn't regret it.
But you could see that he did regret. He wouldn't say it the way Medvedev did tonight. I don't think.
I'm glad Medvedev.
I certainly never saw that.
It's good that Medvedev owns it quickly these days, at least. He didn't used to.
Yeah, it was good. I mean, it wasn't even a particularly great Daniil Medvedev press conference tonight, was it? But it was just sort of, it was just great, as they all are.
Yeah, again, I said to Simon as we were sort of shuffling out of the room, world number one in press conferences, Daniil Medvedev. And, you know, he agreed, I think, Simon. You know, Simon mentioned how good Federer has always been in press conferences, but yeah, they must not miss his press conferences, because he's going to open, he's going to be honest, he's going to reflect, he's going to have interesting things to say, he's going to be really polite when he says it as well. It's, you know, he's very, very good in the press room, in the same way he's very, very good on court as well. He really is sort of covering everything. Just on that point you made, David, about it being similar or reminding you of Federer Djokovic, I sort of had the same thoughts. And look, who wins the Federer Djokovic matches on a hard court?
Absolutely.
In the slams, always Djokovic. And it can very often feel like Federer's the better player, because, as you said, he's or Tsitsipas in this case, because he's hitting these incredible highs and doing these incredible things. But in the crunch moments, I think Medvedev's game style suits it more. He can go into a sort of lockdown mode, whereas Medvedev
doesn't have to take the risks.
Take the risks, which Tsitsipas has to take and which Federer has to take. And yeah, it's just a game style which I think lends itself more to high pressure moments. And then when you combine that with the incredible mental strength that Djokovic and Medvedev both have, it's so tough to beat, even for players with the skills of Federer and Tsitsipas.
Great watch, though, those first three sets, I thought.
One last bit of very minor aggro to touch upon is that Stefanos Tsitsipas was eventually given a coaching warning in the third set. And this came about, it transpires, as a result of Ava Azdaraki Moore, the Greek umpire, being assigned to stand underneath the Stefanos Tsitsipas player's box and listen out for coaching instruction being yelled by Apostolos Tsitsipas, which is common. Tsitsipas has been given warnings about it in at least two of his matches this fortnight. I think a lot more than that. I mean, Tsitsipas said himself, you know, it happens all the time. He barely even notices now. But you had Ava Azdaraki Moore sort of loitering in the tunnel like a covert agent, doing hand signals to the chair umpire to indicate he's done it, give him a warning. And the warning came. And yeah, it was a very quirky little moment. And if you want to hear the very interesting things that Stefanos Tsitsipas had to say about the fact that he is repeatedly getting these coaching warnings, then subscribe to the newsletter, because Matt asked him about it in press afterwards. In fact, Matt got congratulated by the other journalists in the room for asking the question that they all wanted to hear the answer to, but hadn't asked. To be fair to Tsitsipas, best press conference of the fortnight today after his win. He wasn't chippy, he wasn't as weird He wasn't as he was more natural, I think. He was just a bit more sort of off the cuff and saying things as he saw them, I think. And, you know, I didn't agree with a lot of the ways that he saw things. There were a few sort of logic failures in there. He sort of said, he argued with the why he was getting coaching warnings, because he said, look, it doesn't matter what my dad's shouting, I don't hear it. He said, I'm so in my own world, I'm never going to hear anything my dad's saying. You know, failing to understand that that doesn't matter. If your coach is doing it, that's what you get the warning for. And then he sort of went on to the subject of, you know, whether coaching should be warning worthy anyway. But I am encroaching onto newsletter territory, so I encourage you to subscribe to the newsletter and check out that excellent content in there. So that is your final, your men's final. Rafael Nadal against Daniil Medvedev, both men going for history. Medvedev once again trying to stop a member of the big three going for history. It is absolutely delicious.
Do you think Netflix want a third, fourth place playoff between their two guys, Tsitsipas and Berrettini, both followed by the cameras but won't be featuring in the final?
Netflix want a rewrite, I think.
Mind you, they've got enough material from this.
I'd say they've got off to a decent start, haven't they? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I bet they want to be filming Medvedev, though. Anyway. Right then. So that is Sunday night. What about tomorrow night? We have Ash Barty against Danielle Collins. We also have the special K's, but I'm not going to make anyone do predictions there. We have Ash Barty against Danielle Collins for the women's singles title. What's going to happen? Who's going to win it?
I think Barty will win it. I think she will. I think it will be close, two tight sets is what I would expect. But I think Barty will just come up with the answers. I think Barty right now is like Federer 2004. She is just at the height of her powers, and I'm not too sure at the moment. I mean, I think maybe Osaka a year ago, you know, we've seen Andreescu at an incredible level, but I think Barty is just so far and above the most talented player in the world. And I think Collins will give a really good account of herself, but I think it'll be a bit like Federer-Roddick or something like that, you know, where you've got this player who's hitting the ball really well, and against anybody else in the world, they'd win. But Barty, I think, is just too good.
I think I agree. I think it feels like a question of whether Barty's just pure level, as David is saying, is going to be too much for Collins, because I think Collins will try and make it the match she wants. She will try and intensify the occasion, whereas I think Barty will be trying to sort of dampen it and quash it. And ultimately, I think Barty will be able to do that just by how good she is, just by her game causing Collins problems. And if all else fails for her, I think she can fall back on that serve. You know, I know I bang on about it, but Ash Barty's serve is so good. And I think even if she's having a bit of a tight day, I think that'll help her stay in the match. So I'm going Barty as well.
I'm going for Barty, but I think I would go for Barty in three. I think there's going to be a wobble in there. I do, and I think Danielle Collins will be right there to pounce on any wobble. Yeah, I think Barty in three. Ultimately, I think the tennis, as you've both said, will be the decisive factor. The tennis is just that much better that it can withstand a wobble. But I would be surprised if there wasn't a wobble. And the wobble will make it fun, folks, I think.
Oh, I mean, the whole occasion is going to be extraordinary. You know, Ash Barty, first Australian woman in an Australian Open final since, what is it, 1980? That's such a big deal. And, you know, that's that aspect I'm looking forward to sort of as much as anything, really. Just trying to get a sense of the atmosphere and soaking it up. And it's a special day tomorrow.
And Daniil Medvedev will be watching on his phone during dinner, as he told Jim Courier in his on-court post-match interview, which was an amazing moment.
A last-minute save, wasn't it, really?
Yes, sort of, yes. So what else is there tomorrow? There is the Special K's, folks. The night session from 7:30 is Barty against Collins, followed by Kokkinakis and Kyrgios against Matt Ebden and Max Purcell. Before that, you've got your junior finals. We'll let you know who your ones to watch for the future are. The girls' final is Petra Marchenko of Croatia. She's the top seed. She is Croatian, and she is taking on Sofia Kostulas of Romania. She's the eighth seed. And the boys' final is the American Bruno Kuzuhara, which is just a brilliant name, against Jacob Mensik. And Kuzuhara is the top seed, I think, in that. Mensik, the fourth seed. So both top seeds through to the junior finals. That's tomorrow. Just one last thing from today, and that is the mixed doubles title, which has gone to Ivan Dodig and Kristina Mladenovic. They beat Jamie Furless and Jason Kubler 6-3, 6-4. And considering Kristina Mladenovic was the first person out of the tournament in singles on day one, that's it's a nice ending for her to the fortnight. And in their speech, they said they've been, you know, trying to play together for more than 5 years or something, I think. So they've finally got it together and they've won the title. So disappointment for the Aussies, but still a fairy tale fortnight for them. So that's it. Your day 12 tennis podcast. There's only two more to go. My God. We'll, of course, be back tomorrow with our penultimate tennis podcast, reviewing whatever happens in the women's final and looking ahead to the men's final. We will have Carter and Darwin and Gerald the Cat as our mascots. I scored today, Carter. Scored big with Rafael Nadal in four. Billie Jean. We'll be back with Billie Jean King and Alana Kloss as her mascot. We'll have Charlie, our lovely Australian Open mascot, Charlie the Beagle. Keep sending content, Charlie. We'd love some Charlie stuff to post on our Instagram over the weekend. We have got Chris Albert Lee and Kyle Weingartner, our executive producers and top blokes. And we've got shout outs.
Yes, I enter this with a bit of trepidation tonight after yesterday.
No penis gags. My rule for myself. No accidental penis gags.
Right, we have Alec Mills from Bristol. I think we're safe.
Right, Alec.
A little bit like Alan Mills, the former
Indeed.
Wimbledon referee.
Do you remember when he was the judge on our end of season awards one year?
Oh, I do.
That was great,
I do,
wasn't it?
Vividly, yeah.
That was recorded at the Royal Albert Hall.
At the Royal
Hall,
Albert Hall,
it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
My granddad was called Alec by some people. Alec.
Thank you so much for supporting us and being our friend, Alec.
Yes, thank you, Alec.
We also have Dennis Curley from Minneapolis. Who
says, I thought you were going to say Dennis Kudler then.
Dennis says, thanks to David's 2021 shout out of my name, in which he referred to curly whirly bars, my sister-in-law, Julianne, had some sent to me via Amazon. They were delicious.
We've changed his life.
Oh,
that
so
has
proud.
Saved me from doing a really tenuous penis gag. Thanks, Matt.
Oh, God.
Thank you, Dennis.
And we also have Natalie Hewin from Sydney, who is appropriately a huge Rafael Nadal fan. And Nadal was her topic on Mastermind.
Oh, blimey.
Hang on.
Is this a joke?
I'm having a very vague memory of seeing an episode of Mastermind, or certainly being texted by a friend to say, stick Mastermind on.
Nadal was a topic. I mean, Is there an Australian version of Mastermind?
Hang on. Is she saying she's appeared on Mastermind and that was her topic? Or is she saying that would be her topic?
No, she's appeared on it and she said she was narrowly defeated by not studying the list of awards he's won in Spain from his ATP profile.
Wow. Natalie, please send us more info on that.
Mm.
What country, what nation's Mastermind it was? I don't know if it goes out anywhere but the UK. Is it available on YouTube? Just more info, please, Natalie. Get in touch.
How cool, though.
Yeah,
that's amazing. Yeah, that's serious tennis fan credentials. So thank you to everyone in our shout-outs list today. Dennis, Alec and Natalie, thank you to all of our friends. If you want to become a friend, then the link to do so is in our show notes. Definitely subscribe to the newsletter if you haven't already. Tell your friends, leave us an iTunes review, do all of that stuff and definitely join us tomorrow for our penultimate Australian Open Daily Tennis Podcast. We'll speak to you then.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.